I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. If you've got a smartphone, you're walking around these days with the algorithmic revolution in your pocket. And we all have a notion of the many things it's doing for us and to us.
With Waze, you always get the fastest route, based on real-time traffic shared by millions of fellow Wazers. Navigating is super easy. All your destinations are one tap away.
Push your fitness further with Fitbit Charge 2. Use Pure Pulse Continuous Heart Rate to help optimize intensity during workouts using zones and automatically tracks your sleep to show how long and how well you've slept. Find moments of calm in your day with personalized guided breathing sessions based on your heart rate. Because every day is an opportunity for a life better lived.
The Apple Watch app is the first research app to use the Apple Watch. So those sensors can be used to collect physiologic data during seizures.
What's really amazing about an iPhone is you have it in your pocket. You don't need any special equipment. Here's the phone. We can do this science, we can do this medicine with a phone.
It's not long. That tiny moment of anticipation before the next song. But it's all the time we need. We've already studied every note, every beat, to bring you this song, your song, right here.
What we're getting to know about algorithms is sort of summed up in a program called Deep Patient at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, mining the records of 700,000 patients. They have a tool now that can predict your own medical risks when you walk in the door, risks of liver cancer or schizophrenia with uncanny accuracy. But the designers of Deep Patient readily admit that they do not know how their crystal ball wires up all that data or gets its answers. So, welcome to the rapidly evolving regime of algorithms. Welcome to the vast but more and more inscrutable power of computation. Some say we have passed a point of no return in the outsourcing of our minds, yet there is resistance to and a lot of questions still to argue. For example, has the idea of free will expired, like our bygone privacy? Or suppose that the machines are in fact better tuned than human brains are to the way the world really works. What then? What if it takes a leap of faith, as was said about religion back in the day, a leap of faith to believe that that machine really has the truth? The anthropologist Nick Seaver at Tufts University studies in particular the algorithms that read you and your taste and the people who build those recommendation services around the music or the books or vacations that you're going to like. Nick Seaver, welcome. You're the anthropologist on Mars out there. That Pandora commercial we just heard talks about all the 450 elements that go into making a musical experience, and then they come up with some pretty awful music to illustrate it. No Mozart there, nor Art Tatum. What's going on in all this recommending?
Yeah, so what Pandora is doing, they describe in that ad, is they're trying to analyze music. They're trying to represent songs computationally and define patterns in people's listening activity, right? So they're going to look at the songs that you listen to. They're going to identify qualities that those songs have, and they're going to try to find other songs with those qualities. And like you just mentioned, this makes a lot of people really uncomfortable because we have this deep-seated idea that there's no accounting for taste, right? That's our sort of common sense about what taste is. And that's basically all that these systems do, right? They try to count it up. They try to represent it back to you. Some people find them to be great. Some people really love their Pandora stations. They love their algorithmic radio on Spotify and so on. Other people don't like them or hate the idea of them existing.
Sounds very suspicious to me. It's very Facebook-ish that there will be music that you want to hear in the morning, for example, or when you're down to get you up, or when you're up to get you down, music with your children, all this sort of stuff. It's not the way we thought about music. But you do not the technology, but the people. You're an anthropologist, a people watcher, looking, as I would be, for the rules that these people are applying. Who are they?
Yeah, so I did field work while I was doing my anthropology PhD with the kinds of people who design algorithmic recommender systems for music. And I was interested in questions like, what do they think taste is? Why do they think people like the music they like? And there's a kind of simple thesis you can have, right, which is that if you think people like music for one reason, you can build a software system that uses that reason. Pandora, for instance, is built around the idea that you like music only because of how it sounds, right, not because of what your friends like or something like that. But if you thought people like music because of what their friends like, you might try to plug into Facebook and find out what their friends on Facebook are listening to. So I'm interested in how the people who build these systems make sense of their work, because for all we talk about algorithms being this sort of post-human imposition on humanness, if you go to the offices of any of these companies, they're full of humans. There's all sorts of humans there, and they're making decisions in kind of old-fashioned human ways, even though they seem to be doing something that's quite different.
Duke Ellington said, unforgettably, if it sounds good, it is good. And yet this seems to strip away entirely the question of, is it good music or not?
Oh, yeah. We lost that a long time ago, I think.
Really?
I mean, that would, speaking from the social sciences, I think that's not a position that most of us would have held for a long time. We would tend to talk about your taste as something that, you know, identifies you as a kind of person, not that you know that some music is really good or not. Certainly the assumptions built into these systems do not allow for the idea that there is a really, truly good music out there, and if only we could find it, we could recommend it to everyone.
We remember affectionately those people in record stores who sort of knew you and sort of knew what was coming in and would want to make a match. Is that the mentality you observe?
Yeah, so I think the people who work in these systems have this sense that, you know, there's a long lineage of usually sort of male figures who were important. They were, we would call them cultural intermediaries, right? The guy in the record store, the A&R guy at the record label, all these people who sort of filter and decide what's good for particular audiences. And they, the people working on these systems say, okay, well, who am I then? Am I the record store clerk? Am I some other kind of person? And they do try to imagine themselves as, you know, a kind of weirdly multiple record store clerk. Sometimes people will talk about wanting to recommend, you know, good or cool music to people. But while they say that, I think they sort of know that it's not correct, that they know that there's not an absolute good taste. They know that when they say that such and such music is cool, that they can't really justify that. But they're going to say it anyways.
So what are they trying to bring to you, and how are they trying to get you in?
Yeah, so the goal of most of these systems is to optimize some kind of metric. And this is not only true in music, but in all sorts of algorithmic fields. So the key metric that I saw people try to work on in sort of the industry was something that I call captivation, or they would call engagement. So this goal of sort of getting you to listen more. So how do I know that I've recommended music that you like? Well, you keep listening to it, so you must like it. So they would basically do any kind of change in a system. They would measure what kind of effect it had on listening times. And they would use this kind of language of either addiction to say, you know, I want to get my users hooked on this service, or sometimes, weirdly enough, a kind of trapping language, right? Like, I want to capture my audience's attention. I want to keep them on the system. I want to capture market share. I noticed a lot of people using this kind of subtle trapping language.
Let's hear it in a sentence.
Oh, okay. So what the trapping language is like?
Yeah.
What's the model? Well, so their idea is they want to keep you around, and in part that is justified by saying, you know, well, if you like it, you'll stay. If you stay, that means you probably like it. To my mind, anthropologists, we tend to think a little bit weirdly broad. So for me, when I hear this sort of trapping language, I think immediately of eel traps from Papua New Guinea. This is a sort of stock reference for anthropology theory,
really?
Which we used. Yeah, it's, you know, you would think that an algorithm is not a lot like an eel trap. We're talking about, imagine a cylinder made out of bark with a sort of a frog at one end and a trap door at the other end, and an eel swims in and gets stuck. So when anthropologists talk about traps, we talk about a few things. One is that in the design of the trap, you have this kind of model of the entity you're trying to trap, right? So I have ideas about what eels are like, and I'm going to build my trap accordingly. If I think that eels are really strong for some reason, whether or not I'm right, I'm going to build a trap that's really heavily reinforced. So you may wonder, okay, what does this have to do with algorithms? If you look at the people building music recommenders, they will have this idea about the kind of listener that they're trying to capture, right? And often the kind of listener that you're trying to capture if you're building a recommender system is this sort of mysterious person that they'll call sometimes the laid-back listener. It's a person who doesn't want to interact at all, right?
Easy listener.
Easy. They don't say easy, but yeah, that's sort of the same idea.
Contemporary rock or sort of.
Well, it's not necessarily genre-specific. And they often will say it's not even person-specific, right? In some situations, you don't want to interact with the system to get music to come out, right? Or some people just say, play some music. I don't want to pick it. I don't want to make a decision. And in order to capture this person, in order to capture this listener who doesn't want to do anything, you have to kind of trick them into interacting with you, right? You have to collect all this data about them in order to make recommendations. Because if they never say something like, you know, okay, thumbs up, I like this, they never skip anything, how are you supposed to know what they like?
Do they know, Nick, how passionately we are involved with our music, how proud we are of our taste?
Oh, absolutely, because these are people, right? The people who work in these systems, a lot of them actually have backgrounds as musicians.
But you say they're treating us in some sense as animals, purely behaviorist responders.
Yeah, there is a behaviorist heritage here for sure. And I think a lot of people find that problematic, both inside and outside of these industries. But a lot of the people who work there, you know, they are very avid music fans, and they find that the difference between them and the people who they imagine to use their systems is actually that the people who build these systems are extremely into music, right? They like music. They love having a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of music, whereas the people who might want to use a recommender and not pick anything, that kind of person, if you want to try to capture them, you can't show them, oh, look, we have the most obscure jazz record, right? They don't care, ostensibly.
Sum it up before the break, Nick.
Sure.
What are they learning about human taste, the sovereignty of it, the real treasure of it?
Yeah, so they're learning a few things. They're learning what patterns sort of emerge. They're trying to do things like monetize this taste data that they have to say, okay, maybe we know from your music taste that it correlates with your political leanings, and therefore we can play advertisements on your particular stream that we predict will be related to your political leanings because of the way that you listen to music. They want to know how things cross over with each other like that. They want to know, that's sort of the main idea, right? They want to sort of use music to say, okay, we know who you are. We have this idea that music is intrinsic to your identity. And so a music recommender, in some sense, is going to get you at that key, right? It's going to get you at who your users really are, speaking of, as if you're an engineer.
Oh, to uncommodify music and all of these things, I think.
Yeah.
We're talking about algorithms with Nick Seaver, with Maura Weigel and Ben Tarnoff coming up. Also, algorithmic theology. When humans set about creating an all-knowing higher authority that cannot itself be known. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. The real thing, not an algorithm. This is Open Source.
Echo is connected to Alexa, a cloud-based voice service, so it can help out with all sorts of useful information right when you need it. Echo can hear you from anywhere in the room, so it's always ready to help.
I can have the water running, I could be cooking, the TV can be on in the back room, and she still can hear me.
You can even reorder from your Amazon shopping history by simply asking Alexa. Echo is always learning new skills.
We actually discovered that we can teach Alexa to learn my accent. Alexa, add Nescafe on my shopping list.
I have added Nescafe to your shopping list.
And becoming part of the family.
Ready to go?
Yeah.
Alexa, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Our guests, Maura Weigel and Ben Tarnoff, are co-founders and editors of the brave young magazine called Logic, Big Questions, and brilliant writing 4 times a year about technology. Welcome back. Since I've seen you, we're more and more aware of being in some sort of transition around artificial intelligence, algorithms, machine learning. Locate us, Ben.
Absolutely. Well, look, thanks for having us. We're having a big public conversation now of the kind we've really never had before about the impact of technology on our lives, our personal lives, our public lives, our political lives, our sexual lives, and specifically about algorithms, and specifically about algorithms that are functioning on these big platforms, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google. And I think what we're experiencing is still the fallout from the 2016 presidential election, you know, the so-called tech backlash that seems to continue to gather momentum, which has surprised me, you know, is really a function, I think, of the media in particular observing how the Trump campaign used social media so effectively.
Right.
And I think it's very welcome. I mean, no matter the reason that we're having this conversation aside, I think it's very welcome that we're finally starting to think about how these things function and how we might reorganize them to make them function better.
Ben, that's an absolutely stunning assembling of all the elements here, or some of the many, many elements. It seems to me it would take almost machine learning to balance them, to sort them out. But first, the disenchantment in Facebook land, compounded by Mark Zuckerberg, the founder, and his revisions in the famous news feed. I don't want to get deep into that, but it is feeding a sort of dystopia or dyspepsia around this whole subject. And it does involve the 2016 election and the ongoing Trump campaign. What's to do about it? Moira, where do we jump in?
Well, there's a lot to say about what's new about it. One thing that strikes me is this new emphasis that Zuckerberg made. I'm forgetting now, Chris. I'll have to ask you to remind me when exactly he made the statement that Newsfeed was going to shift towards prioritizing friends and family, community sharing
Can't
over
give
news
you
items.
Within the last 8 weeks.
But I think that another kind of interesting conversation we're continuing to have is about the revision of the public-private division as we've understood it. This idea, I think, you know, people often talk about having free speech on some of these tech platforms or having the right to certain kinds of information on these platforms. But Facebook is not a public square. Facebook is a large private company. And to the extent that this conversation we're having is sort of demystifying and clarifying some of these ideas that we've mapped onto it, I think it's productive.
My headline on your big map would be, is this the end of the Enlightenment? Are things truly falling apart this time, including our politics, but our sense of human mastery? A sense that reason, democracy, science will work these things out.
Here I have to take the line of Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer that, you know, the problem with enlightenment isn't that it's too rational, that it's not yet rational enough. I actually think, if anything, what we've seen is sort of a massive mystification and ascription of a certain godlike power to these machines that, in fact, like all machines, are built by humans. And I actually think that one of the most productive elements of this moment we've had over, say, the past 6 months during this tech lash that we're living in, is the ability to start talking about these systems as systems that are built by human workers, are built by tech workers and the service workers who support and take care of them. But really the ability, I have to quote Ursula Le Guin, RIP, you know, that capitalism, like everything human, can be changed. I'm paraphrasing, not quoting. Ben could quote, I bet.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point, right? I mean, are we talking about the technology? Are we talking about the social organization of the technology? In practice, sometimes those are quite difficult to tell apart because the social organization is embedded at the level of code, right? It's actually being inscribed as the programmers, these tech workers are creating it. But we can reorganize the technology. I think if that's the one big takeaway from this conversation, that should be it.
Say it again.
We can reorganize the technology, that ultimately this is a question of power, a question of politics.
We being the American government, we being...
Well, hopefully...
20-something...
Let's say we the people. I mean, I think my... let's say my model of politics relies on the idea that change happens when you can build mass mobilization from below. I think, frankly, we're still very far from that when it comes to technology, but we've seen some hopeful signs.
So find a way to make it political.
Well, it's already political. I would say...
Well, I mean talkable, arguable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Find a new language, find a new set of symbols, a new set of metaphors for making these issues accessible. As Moira is saying, demystifying them, demystifying the power that these companies have, realizing that these are machines that are built and maintained by humans and that we can remake them to do the things that we want them to do.
Hold it right there. We like Rob Horning's thoughtful scrutiny of social media in the internet magazine called Real Life. In conversation this week, he made an observation somewhat like yours, Nick, that we use internet algorithms to build up a sense of self. And they hold us by flattering us.
Ultimately, they're trying to sell you a sense of yourself that depends on the platform, whether that be Facebook or Twitter or Amazon or whatever it might be. The idea is that we have all this data on you. We can construct a sense of who you are that is both true but also exciting. It's both you and not you in a sense. You're seeing a reflection of yourself that you can enjoy. You can like discover things about, oh, these are the sorts of books I like. Oh, this is the sort of content I should be reading. Or, oh, these are the friends I should be trying to reach out to. Or do you remember this thing you posted from 5 years ago? Turning up these things about yourself that you get to enjoy as a consumer. So you get to consume yourself.
So it's you and better than you, more interesting than you, probably better looking than you.
Right.
Speak of this mirror. You're talking about this reflection. It could be a rose-colored mirror, wide-angle mirror, funhouse mirror. What are we looking at?
I think it's a little bit of all those things. So the sense that like the algorithm becomes the most important gatekeeper, the most important friend who you need to like get to know, and that's always shifting. So you end up in this sort of strange self-discovery loop, trying to figure out what it is that can secure attention online, and it sort of reorients the self towards attention-seeking. This is sort of one of my hypotheses, is that you turn to a thing like Facebook or a thing like Twitter, not just to communicate or to like see who's doing what, but to see a reflection of yourself. If you feel a sense of who am I, it's there to remind you. It literally presents memories to you, like here's some memories, here's some things you did in the past, here's some friends you should have. And those things, I think, are reassuring about like, oh, myself is being built out of the things I'm doing and I don't have to work to do that. The algorithms are revealing who I am. They say, here, we have organized who you are for you, and you can just look at it, you can consume it, you can flip through it, you can scroll down into it. It doesn't require some kind of combative process of self-knowledge. It just requires you opening your phone and flipping through these things that we've set up for you, because that's who you are.
Nick Seaver, I like that idea that the phone or Facebook, wherever you meet it, is the place where you are reassured somehow by this image of the self you've been creating all along. Sort of, it's a little bit like going back to fourth grade. That was me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people, and anthropologists see this all over the world and not algorithmic settings, that people sort of learn who they are from outside of themselves, right? And I think the question, as Ben and Moira have brought up, is what kinds of situations exist around you that you can learn about yourself from, right? So the problem isn't so much that, oh no, ourselves are coming from outside of ourselves, because I think that's a basic fact of having a self. But the problem is, what is the nature of the sort of stuff outside of me that I'm learning about myself from? Is it a big corporation that's organized to extract attention from as many people as possible and sell it to advertisers? Or is it something else? Is it something organized around a kind of a different set of principles? Because it could be.
Yeah, I think of all the other ways that you can construct yourself, including, you know, reading great literature, singing great music, you know, hiking, you know, 6 months a year or whatever. So many, I don't know, more familiar, defensible ways, I think.
I think it's important not to, sorry, this is Moira. I think it's important not to mystify the past, though, or rather to romanticize past technologies. I mean, a book is a carbon and oil-based technology that's printed on paper at a certain moment in history, sold on train platforms, moved around in lending libraries. So I think that as much as I deeply...
But I never read it as technology, Moira. I read it as meeting the greatest minds I can find, the most inspiring, the most moving.
Nonetheless, and yet, but that meeting is mediated through a particular material device that you hold in your hand and carry with you. You know, an ancient Roman didn't carry around a printed paper novel in that same way. The sort of, I think often, I was thinking when Nick was speaking about how a self only gets to know itself through interactions with others. I think the same thing could be said of the category of the human in general, that it's like human being is always in an unstable category that we sort of realize through language, through sociability, through our technologies. We've never been human in any kind of straightforward way. And so to that extent, I think it's helpful to not to romanticize a sort of past era in which the technologies we used to self-fashion were different, but rather to raise the kinds of questions Ben and Nick are pointing toward about who owns the technologies that we're using to self-fashion and how are they not using those to sort of maximize profit, capture attention? What are the motives organizing them? Because I think we've never been human or been selves in a pure way that's anterior to technology.
Could I go maybe even wider? I mean, 2 years ago, we thought we were warned that artificial intelligence was apocalyptic. It was the end of human control. Overall, today, I would say that the algorithms and machine learning are gaining on us. And they make me want to rediscover what it was I loved about humanism, about Steve Pinker's Enlightenment, for example, which seems about to be overtaken by these machines. Possible, Ben?
Well, I'd say a couple things. I think first it's important to understand what artificial intelligence means in practice versus how it's represented in the media. I think the media representation of artificial intelligence tends to be quite reckless. I think there's a lot of discussion of folks like Elon Musk and their fantasies of some type of superintelligence mm-hmm. destroying all of us. Mm-hmm. None of these fantasies are particularly realistic if you speak to the people who are in the actual field of artificial intelligence. It's true that computers have become very good at learning how to perform specific tasks better, specifically through the field of machine learning. When it comes to the question of what folks call general AI or strong AI, of really mm-hmm. building a mind, building a consciousness, we are extremely far away from that. We may not even reach that. So to that extent, I think that although it's true that we are building powerful tools that are good at doing very specific things, I think this broader fears of our humanity being submerged by the machines is somewhat overblown.
And okay. I think if I can jump in, not only is it overblown, it serves an ideological function that's quite productive for Silicon Valley or tech CEOs like Elon Musk. This idea that the kinds of political problems, the grotesque inequality that American society is facing at the moment is a kind of inevitable result of this incredible artificially intelligent technology that's being built conveniently elides the fact that, in fact, it's the redefinition of, you know, the workforce is contingent, the elimination of certain kinds of labor law protections and social goods that are driving American inequality, not sort of RoboCop or some sort of fantastically intelligent machine that tech CEOs are just so sorry they built, but they can't help it. I think that it's really important, not just for accuracy, but I mean, for the sake of a humanist politics, if we want to go there, to bring that discourse back down to earth.
You're emphasizing the public-private imbalances here. We're coming to make villains of those corporate giants, Google, Apple, Facebook, whatever, for their profiteering or the use and abuse of these algorithms. But the social activist Cade Crockford of the ACLU made the point this week with us that government is in on algorithms, too, at many levels. I asked her how people can and do use algorithmic thinking to level the playing field with police, for example.
We're interested at the ACLU, certainly, in ways that we can monkey wrench these systems without, you know, running afoul of the law, of course. There's been some really interesting art in this space. There's an artist named Adam Harvey who does anti-surveillance art. There are other folks who have figured out ways to paint human faces so that facial recognition systems cannot track them. And there is even some really interesting and new science showing that you can even insert one pixel into an image that makes image recognition systems, that tricks them into thinking that the image is something entirely different. In other words, there are really interesting ways that technology can intervene to monkey wrench these technological systems that centralize power and control in the hands of major corporations like Google and in the hands of large government agencies like the FBI. So we're really interested in looking into those spaces.
That was Cade Crockford of the ACLU in Boston, also of the MIT Media Lab. Moira, monkey wrench the heroic image of our friend at Tesla, Elon Musk. I mean, how would you write the balance, in your view, of public and private values in this whole conversation?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. I think that one question that interests me a lot is how we, you know, the kinds of platforms you were just naming, a lot of the platforms that we talk about often are privately owned, but in practice have come to constitute sort of infrastructures of everyday life for a broader mm-hmm. public. So when we think about what Facebook or Amazon or Google has become the infrastructure of, I think there's a real argument to be made, not that we don't, and again, this is sort of pushing back against a techno-determinist understanding. It's not that we don't want to have a search engine that benefits from network effects. It's not that we don't want to have the kind of supply chain that Amazon basically is. It's that we don't necessarily want control of those platforms to be so concentrated in private hands. Mm. So I think it is interesting, like when we have these platforms rising to a scale where they're basically almost like the sidewalk or kinds of like infrastructures of cooperation in everyday life, it does raise the question of whether they fit with our historical definition of public and private at all.
But I'm just wondering, picking up on Kate Crawford, what is the room for organized, enlightened, articulate resistance here, monkey wrench or not?
We published a piece in Logic in our last issue by an artist and programmer called Francis Tsung, who talks about sort of specific strategies that people can use to evade machine learning algorithms and visual recognition. And I know that a number of sort of artists and tech activists are working on that kind of thing. So there certainly are individual initiatives that people can take. I think that what I was talking about is sort of this broader process of social questioning about what kind of popular democratic governance one might want to bring these platforms under, that I feel we're still just starting to have in the current techlash.
How would you start the conversation, Ben? Admitting that our political conversation is pretty well broken at the moment.
Well, look, we're having the conversation right now, right? And that's exciting. I mean, look, I don't think 2 years ago we would be having this conversation. So we're making progress. I think we have to recognize that the level of public discourse, the level of public awareness about technology and specifically the destructive role of technology in people's personal and political lives, we're having that conversation now. The question is, how do we harvest the political energy around this conversation and push it in a productive direction?
Before Mark Zuckerberg becomes president, do you want to add a last word quickly on that one, Nick?
Yeah, sure. I would just say that we need to remember that a humanist approach to this would say that there are humans inside and we can hold them responsible and expect different things of them than we do now, right? Don't let them get away with pretending to be an algorithm, because they're not.
Funny, I was just going to say, coming up, I am not an algorithm, but I play one in the movies. Don't go away. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The first big Hollywood star algorithm appeared or was heard 5 years ago in the movie Her. It was the voice of Scarlett Johansson as the AI phone simulation named Samantha, who was always on hand for the Joaquin Phoenix character. But now lots of algorithms get to play people on television, as in the dystopian Netflix series Black Mirror. We had help from the media critic based in Glasgow called Helena Basil-Morozo in reading this particular episode, in which 20-somethings Frank and Amy are both looking for the perfect match in love and life. Algorithms of themselves do the hard labor of courtship and dating, trying out the many alternatives.
Yeah, but how do I know she wasn't the perfect match for me? I mean,
your ultimate compatible other has not yet been selected.
Well, I have to go through loads of relationships to find it.
That is correct.
Great.
The real people in the real world kind of want to meet their perfect partner, and they use this app. So the app kind of goes through many different options instead of the real people. The app makes all the mistakes, does all the suffering. So the copies of these people in this artificial digital world are making all the mistakes, and then the perfect match is found, and they see each other at the very end. But if you think about it, it's not optimistic at all. So yes, Frank and Amy meet each other at the end and they are the perfect couple, but the humanity is taken out of this dating process. So the mistake-making process is taken out of the dating, of dating.
But there is something on their faces at the end when they discover that they are the perfect match. There's something anticlimactic in their expressions.
It is anticlimactic. You know, it's very ambiguous. It's an ambiguous ending. You know, the excitement of life is about imperfection. The excitement of life is about experiencing pain, experiencing joy, and that's what is taken out of it. Suddenly, you know, artificial intelligence gives us the opportunity to live in a problem-free world or problem-less world. all the films and TV series about artificial intelligence, they pose this question: do you want perfection or do you want to make mistakes? You know, do you want free will?
Heartbreak, loss, despair.
Yes, there's no wholeness of personality without the human experience, without the making mistakes process.
Lena, speak of it as entertainment. Why do so many people like this in their own heads, watching TV, simulation of their choices, and even discovery that imperfection is an unhappy ending? What's the lure of these movies since Her, in my experience, but including, I suppose, The Matrix, Westworld, others that I haven't seen?
I think people are fascinated with perfection. They're fascinated with the perfection of technology. And at the same time, there's a strong element of fear, because this is definitely the world on edge. You know, we're about to cross this boundary, you know, into this kind of fully automated, so to say, world, you know, with driverless cars and fully kind of manipulatable house, you know, where the lights come on if as you enter the house, etc. And it's fascinating. And we don't know yet whether anyone needs us in this world. We're trying to build this world for ourselves, but no one knows whether it will take over and we will be alive at all. We don't know. There's a fear about this as well.
Where is God in this story? Have we created a new one here? Unexplainable, unseeable, but totally authoritative.
I'd say people always wanted this unseeable, invisible, powerful, perfect God. It's always been in our imagination. And for the first time, it's actually there, which is a very scary prospect if you think about it. And now it's time to actually stop and think whether we really want to surrender our willpower, our decision-making skills to this God. That's what we have to think about.
That was Helena Basil-Morozov in Glasgow. Mara Weigel, you wrote the book, Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. You're the authority on that sort of real or imagined courtship and on AI as well. What do you make of Black Mirror?
I have to admit that it's one place the algorithm's off because Netflix tells me to watch it all the time, but I've hardly watched Black Mirror. I have watched Her. The film that you were referencing earlier. And one thing that strikes me ironically, despite its ostensibly futuristic premise, is how profoundly normative and unimaginative the gender relations imagined in it are. I went to see that film around the same time as one of my best friends from grad school, and I remember she left and said, oh, Her's just a movie about dating a guy who's less smart than you. You feel like his secretary, and you're sort of, you know, he's saying, I'm in love, and you're like, oh, I'm having 300,000 other conversations right now. But I think that I'm just being a bit cheeky, but I think that there's something.
Do you want to rewrite the plot? Or?
Well, I don't know, actually. I think that my point is that in both the cases of dating apps, actually, sort of, and in sort of futuristic science fictions like Her, so often we actually map the most conventional understandings of both binary gender and heterosexual desire onto these technologies. Why should an artificial intelligence have a gender at all? And why are all the assistant ones gendered female? You know, we imagine a male AI as smart as Samantha. He's going to take over the entire world. It's like that really bad Johnny Depp movie. I forget the name of. Transcendence, I think. But so I think in a funny way, what's striking to me is how persistent these actually really old-fashioned ideas about gender and sexuality are in that kind of sci-fi scenario.
Where do you all feel artificial intelligence and algorithms infiltrating popular culture, other than trying to broaden the market or dumb it down? I mean, where are the effects you feel?
Well, I mean, one obvious way is through platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I mean, when you think about how much of a normal person's daily media diet is consumed through these platforms, in which curation is algorithmically driven,
right?
That's essentially how people are consuming culture these days.
Pretty scary.
Well, potentially. Again, I mean, look, Chris, I welcome our cyborg future. I don't think that, you know, I love my Pandora station.
I'd rather be a cyborg than a god.
You'll be out there without me, Ben. Sorry.
I'm the eel. I love my eel trap.
It's cozy in there.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I think what Nick was saying earlier is really pertinent to what we're talking about. I'm not someone who knows about the obscure jazz record. I want to be able to turn something on, a station on, and it will just feed me songs that I think I'll like to hear based on a few songs I've heard before. I think that we have to acknowledge the fact that these technologies really do improve the quality of people's lives. And I think I'm less convinced about the Helene's point about that we have to suffer, we have to have a certain amount of pain, a certain amount of discomfort in order to become human.
A search, effort, investment, surprise, delight, disappointment.
But I think
isn't that what makes us?
Sorry to interrupt. I have so many investments in dating apps because of the research I did for my book. I think that in a funny way, I sometimes worry that critics of technology buy too wholeheartedly into what the advertisements for such technologies say it can do.
Absolutely.
A dating app does not at all obviate the work of getting to know someone or sort of engaging in human courtship and sex and love and romance and all that good and horrible stuff we've been doing for ages.
Yeah, I think that we have this problem where both the boosters and the critics at the far ends assume that these systems work all the time and they don't, right? This idea, oh, what if your life was perfect and wouldn't that be boring? That's not what life with algorithms is like, right? Life with algorithms is, like you're saying, full of random frustrations. They might be different than they were before, but these systems are broken all the time, and sort of intrinsically they have to be. They can't, because you do not have the one perfect match, it's going to not work a lot of the time. And that's serendipity, and all this stuff happens weirdly, I think, in the margins. And we should note that there are different systems, right? So Cade Crockford was mentioning, right, these the police sort of identification of people from their faces algorithms. These are not the same thing, right, as a algorithmic recommender system, right? So certain things that are like, yes, sure, the algorithmic recommender system is fine, maybe we would have some different problems, right, with a different kind of system not working, right? We don't just have to assume that the parole detection or the parole prediction algorithm is going to work well, because we are worried that it really won't.
I'm still chasing.
I was just going to say, I think dating apps are so interesting because they're this, in a way, a prime example of a kind of app that sells. I mean, the point of a dating app is to keep you addicted to the dating app. Like, Tinder is a video game about people who might have sex with you that's designed to keep you there swiping Tinder. And I think that we sort of tend to over-invest these apps or to imagine that they can do so much for us, whereas really the reason we're told to believe that is to keep us on the app. And that it's like, I don't know, these apps have all kinds of positive uses. Mm. They help people find all kinds of new people, but love is a process, not a product. And the faster, I mean, the way that we engage with these interfaces, believing that they would make all the decisions, is in a way just an ideological effect designed to addict us to the interfaces.
I got to say, I was thinking of this program as I watched the Super Bowl game on Sunday, and I kept feeling, wow, this whole thing is an algorithmic design. The game itself, all of the commercials, and what are the addictive elements? Saturation of color, action, violence to an extraordinary degree. There were hits in that thing that we should not have seen. We don't want to remember. But the whole project seemed algorithmic. How do you build an audience?
Well, what is an algorithm, right? I mean, the basic definition of an algorithm is it's a set of rules that specify a sequence of operations. So I think in that sense, you know, our society, Chris, has kind of been algorithmicized even before we had this technology, right? I mean, we have a set of rules that specify a sequence of operations. I think those set of rules have been rewritten in particular in the last 40 years in the interest of the richest among us. But in many ways, these technologies are implementing already existing rules, already existing patterns. They're reinforcing patterns. They're not always necessarily creating new ones.
You know, so in a variety of conversations this week, several people brought up that the problem is laziness. We've just gotten too soft to fight for our human variety, our human flawedness, our human responses in each of us individually, but also collectively in our politics. I mean, and again, going back to where you began, Ben, Trump is a symptom. Are we willing to fight for those Enlightenment values of reason, we always say, but a real accepting, loving humanism, and do something about it? Or are we just letting it go? Are we surrendering to the algorithm?
Well, I think, look, we're in a moment of fairly low political mobilization, but we can turn that around, right? Because we're having this conversation about technology. We're in a moment of rising, let's say, big data anxiety. The question is, how do we meet people where they are? What are you going to talk about when you knock on a stranger's door and sign them up, let's say, for a ballot measure or to support a politician or to join an organization, right? That's the question that we need to have, because a lot of people, they like Facebook. They like seeing their friends' baby photos, right? So what are we going to say to them? You have 15 seconds before a stranger slams their door in your face. What do we say to politicize that person?
And what do you say? What would you say, Mario? What would you say, Nick?
I mean, I would tell them about the people who are making these decisions and say, people are making decisions for you. There's no such thing as an algorithmic decision, really, right? There's human decisions that we pretend are algorithmic because people can turn these systems off, and say, are these the decisions that you would want people to be making on your behalf? We don't want to mystify things. I think Moyer said it exactly right earlier, where she said we're sort of mystifying these systems if we pretend that they aren't the result of human choices. So remember, tell people that they are. Remember these are human choices. And now all of a sudden we say, oh, those are choices. Well, we can choose something else. And you absolutely can, right? I think that's a sort of liberatory possibility I see. I don't see it in humanism, I have to say, because humanism gives me hives. This idea that we're going to have a friendly Enlightenment humanism is, you know, that's never really historically been the case. It's always been on the back of terrible subjection of other people who don't get to count as human. And so I, as an anthropologist, just sort of am terrified of a resurgent humanism. I would much rather see a kind of, you know, post-humanism that says, you know what, we were never really human in the first place. Let's find out a better way to relate to each other and to our technologies that doesn't rely on, you know, positing me, an individual person, as some you know, bastion of reason, because God help us if I'm the bastion of reason.
Yeah, I have to agree with Nick there. As the woman in the room, you know, I can't help but think of the ways in which the Enlightenment never treated the vast majority of members of the human species as human. And I think that rather than appeal to a kind of romantic idea about timeless human qualities, were better served, again, thinking about the political economy of these tools. So I'm much less worried about Facebook somehow depriving me of my spontaneous human affection for, you know, someone's adorable children I might see on Facebook, than I am worried about the enormous concentrations of private wealth and power that are being accumulated as a result of how my attention's harvested. I think that I tend to want to reframe the question about humanism as a question of political economy.
Fair enough, but I also, part of humanism in my day-to-day definition of it is our flawedness. It's not about how great we are. It's about how we deal with knowing that we're not all there. We're not adequate to the job, and we're going to die wondering at the end. So it's a kind of humility, not a sentimental or boasting kind of emotion, Mara?
Yeah, I hear that. And I think if it's about flawedness, we're still as human as we've ever been. I don't know what the others in the room are thinking about that.
What are we thinking, Ben?
Except for my husband, Ben, he's perfect.
That's what I like to hear. Right answer. No, look, Chris, I hear you. I think having that humility is absolutely important, particularly when we're facing these titans of techno-capital who tell us that the sky's the limit, when in fact, as Nick and Moore are pointing out, often their promises of what they can even do really don't match the reality of these flawed technologies. I would say, again, though, that I share this basic skepticism of humanism, not necessarily on a purely philosophical angle, but the political cash value of the conversation now, right? We've seen this new effort, the Center for Humane Technology, founded by former people from the tech industry, which got a lot of money and wants to talk a lot about how Facebook is affecting children's brains, right? And I think you're going to see a lot of related efforts around those lines to quote-unquote humanize technology. I worry that that will become a red herring, and that that will distract us from the task of democratizing technology by challenging, as Maura mentioned, those vast concentrations of private power.
I want to go back, final note, to Helena's point about that movie, Black Mirror. it ends in a kind of melancholy, a certain disappointment, because the lovers, the real live lovers, Frank and Amy, realize that they have given up agency in hope on some fantasy of machine perfection, machine choice, and gosh, it's still you again over there. You know, it's still we're in a certain sense stuck with our perfect choices, but we missed all the fun of finding it on our own.
I like to quote the feminist writer Bell Hooks, who says love is a verb, not a noun. I guess it's both a verb and a noun, technically speaking. But I think that apps sell the promise of a certain kind of efficiency that in theory could get you out of love as a process. But why would you want that?
We'll leave it there for the moment with thanks. Maura Weigel, Ben Tarnoff, and Nick Siever. Thanks also to Stephen Wolfram, Helena Basil-Morozov, and Cade Crockford. Thanks also to David Weinberger. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DiGregorio, and the artist Susan Coyne. Paul Kahlo is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our head bot, full-time algorithm. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. Thank you.